welcome to WISA Weekend, WYSO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenny. Coming up in today's program, a conversation with the Neon Movie Theater's Jonathan McNeil about this year's Dayton LGBT Film Festival. Later in the program, Bill Felker has this week's Poor Will's Almanac. Up first, a month from now, attorneys for local governments and drug companies are scheduled to face off in a Cleveland courtroom for the first federal trial in the massive set of lawsuits over the opioid crisis. The lawsuits accuse drug manufacturers of downplaying just how addictive opioids are. The suits allege the drug distributors shipped suspicious orders of pills while looking the other way. Cuyahoga and Summit counties will be the first of more than 2,000 counties, Native American tribes, and others to take their claims to trial. IdeaStream's Nick Castell reports.
Eric Stymack's path to addiction began with a work injury. Several years ago, he says, he was working a side job on a day off.
It was some stage flooring. We were unloading off of the back of a box truck, and it fell off of the lift gate and then landed on my foot and crushed my foot.
Stymack says he couldn't walk for months. He was prescribed OxyContin and then Percocet, he says, and grew addicted to the pills.
I had somebody really, really close to me that overdosed on heroin and died, and I didn't know how to deal with it at the time. So my first thought was, well, if this was something that they were willing to give their life over, what's the deal with it, you know? So that's when I tried heroin for the first time.
After an arrest, Stymack sought treatment at IBH Addiction Recovery Center, where we sat down to talk on a porch overlooking the campus. The residential facility is in the Portage Lakes area, south of Akron. Many people in Ohio and across the country have gone down the same road, beginning with prescription pills before moving to street drugs such as heroin or fentanyl. That's why local governments say drug companies are responsible for lighting the fuse of an addiction crisis that has since exploded. The plaintiffs say the waves of addiction and overdose deaths that followed have strained local communities.
An average episode here is going to cost between $15,000 and $20,000.
Jonathan Wiley is the executive director of IBH Addiction Recovery Center. Treatment centers like this one often bill Medicaid for those costs, he says, and also receive funding from county addiction and mental health boards. And then there's the cost to medical examiners, first responders, families who have lost loved ones to overdoses, and foster care systems taking care of children. Wiley says no settlement amount can truly match that.
There's no number they can come up with that's going to meet the societal cost of what the opioid epidemic has meant to this state.
In a recent speech, Summit County Executive Eileen Shapiro said she wants to recoup money from the drug industry to continue fighting the crisis.
We did not anticipate being selected to carry the torch for hundreds of counties and thousands of communities across the country. However, we have taken the challenge head on.
Summit County alleges that sales representatives from several opioid manufacturers made more than 900 visits to local prescribers over a 2.5-year period. Along with the visits came payments to prescribers, the suit claims, for travel, speaking, food. And the suit alleges that distributors failed to report suspiciously large or frequent opioid orders to federal authorities.
The facts of the case are just incredibly strong. They're devastating.
Andrew Paulus is a law professor at Case Western Reserve University.
They demonstrate really a profit-driven desire to exploit the fact that opioids are inherently physically addictive.
Drug companies have denied the allegations against them. They've argued, for instance, that plaintiffs can't prove the opioid crisis was caused by particular manufacturers rather than by people dealing illicit drugs. Some drug makers have settled with Cuyahoga and Summit directly, allowing the firms to avoid the upcoming trial. Mallinckrodt agreed to a $24 million settlement. Endo settled for $11 million, Allergan for $5 million. Paulus says the courts aren't the best place to distribute money to counties. He says that job should be in the hands of policymakers.
But doing it willy-nilly, state by state, one case after another, and then having these 50 states fight with their respective political subdivisions over how the money gets distributed or who's entitled to recover it in the first place, that just seems absurd.
U.S. District Judge Dan Polster has urged a settlement from the start of the case. But with many defendant companies still holding out, it's possible a jury will get to decide who's responsible for the opioid crisis. For Ohio Public Radio, I'm Nick Castell in Cleveland.
One of the healthiest counties in the Midwest is also the least insured. About 40% of the people in Holmes County, Ohio, do not have health insurance, according to the county estimates. Side Effects Public Media's Paige Flager reports on why that is.
Holmes County is a patchwork of farmland, midway between Cleveland and Columbus. Modest houses perch on sloping hills, and laundry hangs from the clotheslines, flapping in the wind. And around nearly every bend in the road are horses and buggies. Some are driven by farmers in straw hats, others by women with their hair covered in bonnets, babies on their laps. The Midwest is home to some of the nation's largest Amish communities, and Holmes County is one of them. It's projected to become the first county that is majority Amish, and the Amish don't participate in the U.S. health insurance system, not even Medicare or Medicaid. Instead, church members each contribute $90 to $110 a month to an aid fund. Dan Yoder is Amish, and he's in charge of using that fund to pay the community's bills.
Insurance is more for your own benefit. The aid plan is when all the church members get together and they try to help out everybody else.
Yoder even negotiates with health providers the way an insurance company would to get lower prices for medical care. Often, he can get discounts because the community pays bills immediately.
Our health providers will never have a bill that is more than 10 days old. Versus when the insurance company works with health providers on health care, you're talking about 8 months to a year before the providers get payments.
Despite the lack of traditional insurance, the Amish tend to be healthier than their non-Amish neighbors, according to county data. Michael Durr is the head of the local health department and says part of that health disparity is due to the Amish community's lifestyle.
Holmes County is very proud of the fact that we're number one in the state for our environmental factors. That's because we're using a lot of alternate means of transportation. So we see a lot of bicycles, we see a lot of horse and buggy.
Durr says those modes of transportation can help with a more active lifestyle and contribute less to pollution, but it can also make it difficult for the Amish to reach the health care they need. More than half the population of Holmes goes elsewhere for care because the rural county doesn't have the providers.
To bring in the different providers that would take that full gamut of Medicare, Medicaid, private insurance, self-pay, it's really hard to attract those physicians into our community.
There's only one hospital in Holmes County, and it accepts all forms of insurance, including the Amish Fund. There are also nearby Amish-dedicated clinics, like the New Leaf Center. Every year, church members are asked to donate $30 to the clinic. New Leaf specializes in treating children with genetic diseases, like cystic fibrosis or Down syndrome, that are more frequent in the Amish community because of its relatively small genetic pool. Ethan Scott is a pediatrician at the clinic.
There's very few rooms that I walk out of that we haven't had some discussion about what the cost and what the estimated bill to the family and the church is going to be. So you have to be willing to be very transparent. And that is a huge contrast to most healthcare systems.
Scott says that transparency is a positive part of the Amish system. But he says patients can struggle with the fact that money for their healthcare is coming out of their neighbor's pocket.
We do see families really grapple with the burden that they're going to potentially be to their community at large. So it's pretty rare that we'll sit down with the family here the first time and lay out treatment options and that they will consent the first time. They'll usually tell us that they need to go speak with their grandparents, maybe bishops with at their church.
He says in many cases, the church fund will raise money for expensive procedures. But in others, the group decides that the possible benefits for one patient aren't worth the cost to the whole community. In those cases, that person goes without care. For Side Effects Public Media, I'm Paige Flager.
Side Effects Public Media is a news collaborative covering public health in the Midwest. I'm Jerry Kenney. This is WISO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO. Thanks again for joining us. The Dayton LGBT Film Festival returns to the Neon Movie Theater October 10th through the 13th. This year's lineup continues the festival's trend of bringing a wide variety of social and cultural perspectives to audiences over the course of the weekend. The festival is actually a small sample of the diverse films the theater offers throughout the year. Neon manager Jonathan McNeil has just returned from the Toronto International Film Festival, where he viewed some of the films that will eventually make their way to Dayton. We spoke to Jonathan about his trip to Toronto and the upcoming film festival.
I saw several great films, you know, over the course of 9 days. I saw 32 full films. I blog about those while I'm there. I don't blog about the things that I walk out of because I feel like that's not fair. But, yeah, so 32 feature-length films and some parties and all that.
If you're walking out of films, is that based on how many films you actually do see? Is that a time management rather than I just don't like this film?
Sometimes it's a time management. Sometimes it's a, you know I'm going to see this other film at 10 a.m. and I went into this one at 8:30. I know it's not going to be over, but I want to at least get a glimpse of it. Occasionally, it's because I just can't tolerate it anymore.
So you mentioned that you blog on this experience. So how can people catch up on those?
This particular blog is through the Most Metro site. So it's mostmetro.com/tag/TIFF, T-I-F-F, and that's the Toronto International Film Festival.
Great. Let's talk about this year's lineup for the LGBT Film Festival. And you're starting off with a documentary feature that I think will be interesting to a lot of people in the community.
Absolutely. And actually, it is a day earlier this year. So we've extended an extra day just because there was too much good material, which is a good problem to have. It is Gay Chorus Deep South on Thursday, October 10th at 7:30. That's the first screening of the fest this year.
It really is kind of a mission of this particular chorus.
That's right. It is the gay chorus from San Francisco decides that after the 2016 election that they need to go explore the South and see what's going on and kind of spread their love and message of acceptance and embracing the community. And they're very mission-driven. What's interesting is that some of the stories within the chorus are families that haven't seen each other for decades, you know, kind of people coming to terms with their own stories in the South. They fled to the big city. They fled to San Francisco years ago and now are returning. And they have some preconceived ideas as to what they're going to see and what they're going to encounter in the South. And it's not always what they think. So it's there's some enlightening on both sides.
Great. What else do we have for Thursday?
Thursday, there is the opening short that plays along with that is called Slushy. And that is a film by Ben Every, who was our intern last year. And he is actually a graduate of Wright State's film program. This was his senior project. And it's the first time it will be the international premiere for that short. I think it will have some legs on the festival circuit. And of course, Ben will be here along with that film. And it's about a Christian rock group who has aspirations of going on tour.
So a lot of music taking place on Thursday night.
That's right.
You've got short films playing throughout the weekend, including a block on Saturday. I really enjoy talking about those, but let's continue for Friday.
Friday is what was always our opening night. So now it's Friday night. So it's our second night, but we'll still have the party afterward. We're just calling it the after party now instead of the opening night party. But that is a documentary called Circus of Books, which is a really terrific documentary about a heterosexual couple who own a adult bookstore in Los Angeles, and it became a very beloved bookstore. It's interesting. They're a heterosexual couple, and it was all born out of the idea that the wife saw an ad that Larry Flint was looking for someone to distribute his Hustler magazines back in the 70s, and it was because of that that they started meeting business owners and whatnot in the Los Angeles area. What's really interesting is that that protagonist of the film used to write for the Dayton Herald years ago in the late 60s. So really interesting connection to that film, to Dayton. And Rachel Mason, who is the director of the film, she's actually the daughter of this family. So it's a story about this gay bookstore from the 70s until it just closed its doors recently. We get everything in between, you know, the AIDS crisis, the loss of their clientele. We get really interesting story about one of the children coming out and how the mother had issues with that, even though she was clearly making money off the gay community. So really interesting dynamics and really compelling characters.
That sounds great. What else on Friday?
Friday is a short film called Dress You Up Like Mrs. Doubtfire, which is just a short exploring the film Mrs. Doubtfire and how it was really one of the first pieces of media to have, you know, a drag character in it that was really family friendly ultimately.
let's talk about Saturday, which includes the block of short films. And I'm particularly interested in the variety of cultural voices in the lineup this year. So we're talking about diversity within a diversity film festival. How important is that to you to bring to audiences?
You know, it's something that we talk about as a selection committee quite a bit. You know, we look at over 100 films to curate the series for the weekend. And we want to make sure that we're not only bringing each of the LGBT into the fold, but we also want to make sure that we are representing different voices from a variety of multicultural demographics. You know, we want to make sure that a lot of voices are heard. So we have some, you know, more indigenous representation. We have African American voices, and then, of course, international as well. So we really want to make sure that a lot of voices are heard, because I also think that it's important to the greater community to see that the LGBT community isn't just affluent white people that they might see represented in mainstream media.
The Top Drawer Shorts presentation is one of my favorites each year, and you have mentioned several times that either directors or actors from the films will be included again in this year's lineup or this year's presentation to the audience. And I think the audience really goes for that when they can connect on a one-on-one level with people involved in these films.
Absolutely. You know, not only do they get to address how the process of the film came to be, but also putting a face with, you know, we see something on the screen and we think it's so, you know, untouchable and so otherworldly. And then you come to find out that it's really just the gal next door who, you know, has been, you know, putting every dime that she's got into a project, you know. And so it's powerful to connect that human element of creating media like this.
That's great. What else do we have in the lineup for Saturday?
Saturday, we go to a film called St. Francis in the afternoon, just a very unapologetically female film. The committee actually had a discussion as to whether it was queer enough to put in the festival, because the protagonist is not gay, but she is a nanny for a lesbian couple. And at the end of the day, we decided that she goes through enough of a change within the course of the film that is clearly based on her relationship with this lesbian couple that we felt like it merited inclusion. Then later on Saturday in the evening, we have a film called Queering the Script, which is a documentary about women's and lesbians and queer women in television, and how so often they were written out of scripts. And it's an interesting piece. One of the committee members this year, our intern, was a big proponent for this film, and she believes she's a self-professed nerd and really loves this type of discussion about, you know, more kind of intellectual inclusion of lesbians and bi women in media. And we get a lot of very famous people in this piece talking about their roles and how it came to be. What I'm really excited about on Saturday evening is that we just booked three guests to come along with a documentary called Scream Queen, My Nightmare on Elm Street. And we have the two directors of that film and the star of the film, Mark Patton. Mark Patton was in Nightmare on Elm Street 2, and it essentially destroyed his career. There was so much gay subtext in the film that he immediately just didn't work again. And it was panned so terribly that it just destroyed his career. And he would go to horror film fest or, you know, horror con kinds of things for signings, and people would come up and tell him just how much they hated that film. And it's, you watch the film now and it doesn't even seem like subtext. It's really just seems like gay content. It's fascinating, and he's really owned it now. And now there's a certain kind of camp sensibility of the film that I think people are embracing. But it'll be delightful to have him here along with the film.
This is just one more example of how film can be used to tell a story, whether it's personal, nonfiction, or fiction.
That's right. And, you know, what's interesting is this guy, Mark Patton, he certainly was on the rise. You know, his film before that was Come Back to the Five and Dime, Jimmy Dean, Jimmy Dean, with Cher and Karen Black and Sandy Dennis. I mean, it's like he was really, that was a Robert Altman film. You know, he was ready to go, and this was his first leading role, and then his career just fell apart afterwards. So, you know, really interesting to see where we've been, where we've gone, and how far we still have.
this does seem like something that would almost maybe not happen today.
You know, who knows? He was a closeted man himself. And I feel like now maybe it's kind of in fashion to play gay characters, and a lot of, you know, a lot of heterosexual identifying men are, you know, playing gay roles, and so it's not as taboo anymore. But I think that there's still a trepidation from certainly from gay men to play gay roles, and there's still an element of the closet in the entertainment business.
That takes us into Sunday, and we're starting in the noon hour, 12:30, I believe?
That's right, with a documentary called Unsettled. It is directed by Tom Shepard. We really wanted to have Tom here, but he will be in London with this film at that time. And Unsettled is a documentary about refugees seeking asylum in the United States from their countries who otherwise would potentially murder them for being gay. And we get some really hideous footage to just really contextualize the film of people being stoned, people being thrown off of rooftops, you know, for being caught or being, you know, even thought to be gay. And so it's a really powerful film about struggles in other countries and these people coming to the United States and finding a new home. And Tom Shepard directed a documentary years ago called Scout's Honor, which was about an Eagle Scout who was being thrown out of scouting because he came out. And so Tom is somebody that we've known for years here. We had him in Dayton years ago. I brought him before. I was actually part of the Neon. But what's really fun about this is that Jim Klein, a filmmaker from Yellow Springs, was the consulting editor on this piece. He worked with Tom on Scout's Honor as well. And Jim is very proud of this film. And we'd have him here too, but he'll be on an editing gig in LA at the time. So we are really excited to bring this film to town just because of its local connection too.
With Unsettled, what would you say to audience members or potential audience members who may be afraid to come see the film because of some of the footage that you mentioned?
It's not overwhelming. I mean, it certainly will sit with you. It will be there, but I think it's valuable. It's not too much footage. It's just enough to tell us that this insidious thing is legit and that these people seeking asylum are running for their lives, and that's valuable information. On Sunday afternoon, then, we have a film called The Blonde One. So it's not all docs. We could have done a whole series of documentaries this year because the docs were so outstanding. But we have a narrative film called The Blonde One from Argentina, which is a great film, just loads of sexual tension, but it's about two roommates in Argentina. The one is out, the other is more of a Lothario, and lots of machismo, lots of girls on a turnstile coming in and out of the apartment, but there's definitely sexual tension between the two guys. And it's just beautifully filmed, really quiet little film. And, you know, we always like to have at least one film in the mix that's international and it's just more of a kind of prestige piece, and that's this one this year. One last film is our closing film. I do want to say after The Blonde One on Sunday, we'll have pizza from Marion's Piazza. They're the sponsor of The Blonde One this year, and they will have complimentary pizza, just because usually on Saturday we have a break in between some of the movies where you can go grab dinner in the Oregon District or, you know, have a little time off if you're coming to see all the films and you need to eat, of course. But on Sunday we go right through the afternoon into the evening, so we decided to bring in some pizza and have a bit of a little pizza party in between the shows. So I'm happy about that addition this year, because then at 6 o'clock we go into Straight Up, which is a narrative film, very sharp, funny film about a young man trying to figure out his sexuality. And everyone kind of reads him as gay just because he's got a lot of stereotypical attributes of a gay man, but he's pretty certain that he's not gay. And, you know, that was a little frustrating to some of our committee members who thought, like, why isn't he just out? I mean, he's clearly gay. But another voice on the committee said, well, we need to really be addressing the fact that those stereotypes are stereotypes, and that sexual fluidity and bisexuality, or, you know, there's a lot of possibilities out there, and it's not just either or.
Jonathan, it looks like another stellar lineup. I know festival passes and individual film tickets are already on sale. How can people take part in either of those?
Well, I'm sorry to say passes are sold out already. We put more passes on sale than ever before, and they sold out in no time this year. Within 48 hours, 75 passes sold out. So we only put 75 on sale just because we want to make sure that people can see individual films. And we also know that some people are just there to support and will buy a pass even if they're not going to come see all the films. And we want to make sure that we really have a handle on knowing how many single seats we have available. So single tickets are on sale. They're still available for all shows at this time. DaytonLGBT.com is the website, and you can see trailers and read about each of the films and read about all of our amazing sponsors. We could not do this without the sponsorship from numerous businesses and organizations around town. The Friday night ticket for Circus of Books gets you into the Friday night after party, which has complimentary appetizers and booze, a great, great movie, more than likely a Skype with the director, and then a party afterwards. So there's really no better ticket.
Great. Jonathan, thanks so much, and good luck with the film festival this year.
Thank you so much. I appreciate your help.
Jonathan McNeil with the Neon Movie Theater. The festival runs October 10th through the 13th, and you can hear the full interview with McNeil on our website at WYSO.org. I'm Jerry Kenney. This is WYSO Weekend.
This is Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac for the third week of early fall. The transition week to the high leaf color moon, and the first week of the sun in Libra. This past weekend, I drove south through the full range of early fall. Its different sub-seasons were dependent on the progress of the soybeans, or corn, or goldenrod, or tobacco. They were dependent on whether the harvest was complete or pending, dependent on which trees were turning and how much they had turned. Sometimes the specific time of year hinged on the number of fragile cottonwoods along the roadsides, or the advance of the red Virginia creeper leaves, or the number of fading box elders, or catalpas, or sycamores, or sweet gums, or locusts, or hackberries, or maples, or oaks in any given location, each species following its own calendar. I uncovered micro-seasons of place from mile to mile that showed me topographies of past rainfall in the brown or the green of the roadside grass or the sharp rust of vegetation killed by drought. The variety of habitat within a range of 100 miles suggesting the wild complexity in just a few hours of one autumn day. My moods rose and fell while each yard and woodlot opened temporal and spatial cross-section after cross-section, created a process of definition and redefinition in which the borders of this particular day continually shifted and were transformed as though the inevitability of winter were irrelevant. As though I were captured by a game in which natural history, like all history, became simply an arbitrary matter of where I looked. This is Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac. I'll be back again next week with notes for the fourth week of early fall. In the meantime, since seasons are only a matter of perspective, just look for the one that you need.
Bill Felker contributes to newspapers nationwide, including the Yellow Springs News. Bill resides in Yellow Springs. Poor Will's Almanac is also available as a podcast at WYSO.org.
That's it for this edition of WISO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO. Listener-supported and community-owned, serving Southwest Ohio, broadcasting from the campus of Antioch College. We'll be back next Sunday morning at 10. Coming up next on WISO, it's Vic McCunis with the Book Nook.